Your press of the headlines, Palestinian Islamic Jihad fires more than 100 rockets at Israel in an initial response to Israeli air raids which killed 10 Palestinians, including a 5-year-old child. Iran strongly condemns the Israeli regime's airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, warning the regime is responsible for the consequences of its aggression. And China's foreign minister warns the United States not to create a bigger crisis over Taiwan, saying the island has always been part of China and never a country. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story is situation is rapidly escalating in the Gaza Strip after Israeli airstrikes. Palestinian resistance forces have launched retaliatory strikes with a barrage of rockets. Now the attack sounded sirens in the southern Israeli cities of Ashkelon and Ashdod. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says it's fired more than 100 rockets at regime-held territories, says this is an initial response to Israel's earlier airstrikes. Onslaught on Gaza so far left 10 people dead, including a 5-year-old girl and a resistance commander. Nearly 100 people have also been injured. Palestinian resistance groups have called for unity in the face of Israeli aggression. They've ruled out any truce, saying regime must fully pay the price for its actions. Condemnations are pouring in following Israel's deadly airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has described the attacks as criminal, provocative, and adventurous. Nasser Kanani has warned Israel of the consequences of its aggression. Kanani says the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves against what he called the apartheid regime's terrorist measures. Meanwhile, Qatar and Jordan have strongly denounced the attacks. Jordan has also called on the international community to take action to end the escalation. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement also says that the movement will always stand by the Palestinian people and their resistance. Israel has closed its crossings with Gaza, further tightening its blockade on the territory that's been in place since 2007. Now, according to analysts, ongoing closure of the crossings will further decrease the already low standards of living in this tiny seaside territory. Ashraf Shannon has your details.
The Israeli regime has sealed its crossings with the Gaza Strip since Tuesday, further exacerbating the humanitarian situation in the impoverished territory. Currently, there are two Israeli-controlled crossings into the tiny coastal territory, the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing, located on the southernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, and the Erez pedestrian crossing in northern Gaza. The crossings have been partially operating since Israel imposed a tight blockade on Gaza in 2007.
The Israel closure of the crossings for the third day has serious, severe implications on the lives of the Palestinians in Gaza Strip. We are calling on the international community for immediate actions to pressure Israel to lift the blockade in Gaza.
The impoverished coastal territory already suffers from high poverty and unemployment rates. Most Gazans also depend on handouts from international aid agencies to survive.
Closing the crossing point from the Israeli occupation, it's a collective punishment. It's part of blackmail against Palestinian people. Over 2 million people living in Gaza, they are living in the huge jail. The social and economic situation so deteriorated.
For 15 years, the Israeli regime has kept an illegal and inhumane closure on the Gaza Strip, affecting the lives of more than 2 million Palestinians and restricting their freedom of movement.
Gaza crisis, due to the Israeli continuous blockade for 15 years, suffering from serious implications on the economy, on the humanitarian conditions, the employment, food insecurity, poverty increased to unprecedented percentages.
Tel Aviv's move to shut down the crossings will further complicate living conditions in the impoverished territory. According to human rights groups, the Israeli blockade has wreaked havoc on the economy of Gaza and worsened its humanitarian conditions. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Iran says it will rigorously enforce its red lines during the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also underscored the country's right to enjoy the economic benefits of the accord known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He said the Iranian negotiation team pays serious attention to this issue, as well as the country's right to safeguard its peaceful nuclear capability, technology, and know-how. Meanwhile, the Russian foreign minister has described Iran's position on the revival of the JCPOA as absolutely legitimate.
Now, the point is that the Americans are trying to make an altered plan a subject matter of a new agreement, while the Iranians insist on the accord approved in 2015. I believe that Iran's position is absolutely legitimate. The Americans withdrew from the plan, which all the other parties and the Americans themselves had once approved. Considering that Washington tried to dismantle it, Washington should simply recall its position and return to the original accord. That is the problem now.
Lavrov said that Russia's position on the revival of the JCPOA remains unchanged. He added Moscow wants the accord to be restored to its original form, which was approved by the UN Security Council with no amendments or exemptions. The JCPOA was derailed after Washington withdrew back in May of 2018 and reimposed sanctions against Tehran. The remaining parties have held several rounds of talks since April of last year in an attempt to revive the deal. Now, Iran's deputy foreign minister and top negotiator is currently in the Austrian capital for a new round of diplomacy. Ali Bagheri Kani has held talks with the European Union's coordinator Enrique Mora and Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov since his arrival in Austria on Thursday. Mohammad Marandi is an advisor to Iran's negotiation team in Vienna. He believes it's still too soon to be either optimistic or pessimistic about the outcome of the revival talks.
I think we should not be pessimistic, nor should we be optimistic. There has been progress. If you read between the lines from what European officials are saying, it's quite clear that they have adjusted their position on multiple issues. So that means there is progress. However, we still haven't reached the end of the negotiations. We are not quite sure. We're not sure at all whether the Europeans and the Americans, especially the Americans, will accept Iran's conditions. As I said, there is some movement on the Western side, which is a plus. But as they have been saying for a very long period of time, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. So we're still going to have to wait a bit to see what happens.
8 civilians are dead in a bombing which hit a neighborhood in the western part of the Afghan capital, Kabul. Police say 18 people were also injured when a device attached to a hand cart detonated in a shopping center. Now, the marketplace is located in a residential area mostly inhabited by minority Hazara religious group. The Taliban government says the bombing was the work of the enemies of Islam and the country. That's after the Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility for the deadly attack. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has vowed to continue his efforts to overthrow what he calls the country's U.S.-backed imported government. He's demanding a Pakistani chief election commissioner resign to pave the way for holding a fresh election in the country. Our correspondent Nasir Kazmi has more.
Hundreds of supporters and lawmakers of the Pakistani Tehreek-e-Insaf party has filled the streets of the capital Islamabad in a show of support for the ousted premier Imran Khan. They marched in Islamabad's red zone to protest the recent verdict issued by the country's electoral body that declared Khan's party has received illegal funds from foreign individuals and entities.
The charged protesters are not only demanding that Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif and his cabinet step down, but also warning the United States to stay away from Pakistan's internal affairs.
The demonstrators criticized the role of Washington in Pakistan's politics, saying they are seeking independent foreign policy in Pakistan.
What they are doing to us with the drone attacks, the army men who are killed in our country, they just went for the relief work, And after that, the plane was crashed. It is just, I would say, they're intervening in our country.
With the USA, some black sheep from Pakistan, they were also involved into all this procedure. That's why the real hero of Pakistan, Imran Khan, has to resign from his office. And now the question is why? Because Imran Khan, he said absolutely not to all their illegal and to all their unfair demands.
While addressing the protesters, Khan underlined that a fresh election is the only way to get rid of what he called the puppet regime.
The U.S. staged a scripted drama for their own benefit in Pakistan and brought like-minded people into the power to control Pakistan and its foreign policy. So fresh elections are the only solution to get rid of this government.
On the other hand, the Pakistani government has filed a disqualification reference in Election Commission against Imran Khan. The government demands that the electoral body impose a lifetime ban on former premier as well as his political party. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
China's foreign minister has urged the U.S. not to escalate tensions between the two countries, which have soared to new highs over the flashpoint island of Taiwan.
America's habit is to create a problem and then use this problem to achieve its goals. But this approach will not work with China. We want to issue a warning to the U.S. not to act rashly and not to create a bigger crisis. The U.S. says China has changed the status quo of the Taiwan Strait situation. This is false and smearing. What is the Taiwan Strait status quo? Taiwan is part of China. It is never a country. There is only one China. This has been the case since ancient times.
China's foreign ministry also slammed U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. The ministry said that her trip interfered with China's internal matters and undermined the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Beijing has rolled out countermeasures against the U.S., which include ending military talks and meetings between Chinese and top U.S. defense leaders. New measures were announced hours after Beijing imposed sanctions on Nancy Pelosi. This as China held the second day of its largest ever military drills around Taiwan, which the U.S. has condemned.
With her trip to Taiwan this week, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi set off a firestorm in offending China. From the self-governing territory, Pelosi criticized Beijing and its leadership, while carefully outlining the limitations of the U.S. commitment to defend the island.
In the Congress, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans are committed to the security of Taiwan in order to have Taiwan be able to most effectively defend themselves. But it also is about our shared values of democracy and freedom, and how Taiwan has been an example to the world in that regard.
China had warned the U.S. and Pelosi against the visit, as it views Taiwan as a breakaway province that will one day rejoin a one China. In response to Pelosi's Taiwan visit, China's People's Liberation Army on Thursday began the largest military exercises targeting Taiwan in decades.
Tension in the situation across the Taiwan Strait is solely caused by the U.S. side. The root cause is Pelosi's selfish and willful interference with Taiwan, which seriously violates the One China principle. The Chinese government has the right to take all necessary and justified actions to firmly safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity.
In South Korea, Pelosi met with the Speaker of the National Assembly. Seoul has been careful to balance its U.S. military alliance and relations with its largest trading partner, China. Pelosi spoke with South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol on the phone, but the two did not meet, an outcome widely viewed as a snub of the third-ranked U.S. official. House Speaker Pelosi later stopped in Japan, where she met with Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. China later Friday announced sanctions against Pelosi and the suspension on several issues of cooperation with the United States. Frank Smith, Seoul.
UK Central Bank has released a set of bleak numbers, saying the country's national economy could slip into recession for more than a year. The Bank of England has increased interest rates yet again to try and smother soaring inflation. It's the largest rate hike in over 27 years in a developed country where people are already grappling with declining living standards. Saeed Puriza reports.
Britain is on the brink of a recession as deep as the 90s and as long as the 2008 financial crisis, a bleak projection by the country's central bank. The Bank of England says it's trying to stem skyrocketing prices by raising interest rates by half a point to 1.75%, saying the measure couldn't come soon enough.
If we don't bring inflation back to target, bearing in mind the huge scale of the energy shock we're seeing, if we don't bring it back to target, and if we get these so-called second-round effects entering in, it's going to get worse.
It was news that sent a chill among the public, people already feeling the squeeze on their finances.
Leave him out of my home and all the bills on, I have to pay it by myself. I'm on minimum wages as a cleaner, and, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do anyway.
The salary is still the same and the prices are going up, far too up. That's the reason why I have a concern about this.
The Bank of England predicts the economy is going to shrink, with recession starting this year and lasting all the way through the next. That plus the biggest decline in living standards on record and another sharp rise in household energy bills. The bank pins the eye-watering energy price hike largely on rising gas prices owing to the war in Ukraine. But there are other reasons.
It's a whole plethora of reasons coming together. So you can actually look at the effect of the pandemic, what that impacted on manufacturing and consumerability, global trade and supply chains, and the underlying cost of rising commodities, food and other areas. So this is a Gordian knot of elements coming together. Now, untie that knot, and that's what they're going to have trouble doing.
The writing had already been on the wall. Many experts did warn the UK was behind the curve in dealing with rising inflation. Britons are going to see their energy, fuel, and food bills increase significantly over the next year. Charities are warning of a catastrophe this winter. There's talk of creating warm spaces to provide heated sites for those unable to afford their energy bills.
This deluge of bad economic news comes as the country awaits a new prime minister, and that is a month away. But whoever they may be, their job has just become way harder. Cyper is up London.
And that's it for your latest. Thanks for joining us, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Peace campaigners have recently decried the Biden administration's approval of more than $5 billion in missile sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, a move that came weeks after U.S. President Joe Biden visited the leaders of both countries, despite pleas from human rights defenders. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "Weeks After Biden Fist Bumps Saudi Prince, U.S. OKs $5 billion in Persian Gulf Arms Deals." Here's the details. peace campaigners have recently decried the Biden administration's approval of more than $5 billion in missile sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, a move that came weeks after U.S. President Joe Biden visited the leaders of both countries, despite pleas from human rights defenders. The U.S. Department of Defense said the U.S. State Department approved $3.5 billion sale of 300 Raytheon Patriot MIM-104E missiles to Saudi Arabia, as well as 96 Lockheed Martin Terminal High Altitude Area Defense (TAAD) missiles worth $2.25 billion for the UAE. The move came just after the extension of United Nations brokered truce in Yemen, where a U.S.-backed, Saudi-led coalition that includes the UAE is waging a war against Yemeni people. The sales approval also comes days ahead of a virtual Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries OPEC ministerial meeting. The Pentagon claimed that the proposed sales will support the foreign policy goals and national security objectives of the United States by improving the security of a partner country that is a force for political stability and economic progress in the Persian Gulf region. However, anti-war voices argued that such sales will only prolong a seven-year war in which more than 300,000 people have been killed, millions have been displaced, and millions more face hunger and disease in what's widely considered the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Yemeni independent journalist Naseh Shaker tweeted that U.S. professions of commitment to peace in his war-ravaged nation are belied by the Biden administration's desire to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, who will use them in its aggression on Yemen. The missile deals came weeks after U.S. President Joe Biden made a contentious visit to Saudi Arabia, where he met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Emirati President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, and other regional leaders, despite pleas from human rights defenders who drew attention to the coalition's alleged and documented war crimes in Yemen and the Saudi monarchy's repressive domestic rule. A now infamous photo of Biden fist-bumping bin Salman stood in stark contrast with then-candidate Biden's campaign promise to make Saudi Arabia a pariah over the gruesome murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and other human rights crimes. After taking office, Biden temporarily froze arms sales to the country and the UAE and announced the offensive support ban. However, human rights defenders subsequently expressed disappointment when the U.S. administration approved a $650 million air-to-air missile sale to the Royal Saudi Air Force and a $500 million support services contract for Saudi military helicopters. Biden's July trip also followed reports that his administration is considering lifting its amorphous prohibition on the sale of offensive U.S. weaponry to Saudi Arabia. Raytheon shares, which have soared more than 250% since U.S. launched the so-called War on Terror in September 2021, were up slightly on the news of the recent approval. Lockheed Martin stock rose over 2% and is up more than 800% since 9/11.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, my dear friends, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to a new episode of Back to Reality. Hope you're doing great and everything is just fine with you. Now that we have your precious attention, buckle up to fly beyond the surface of your favorite topics. You are listening to Arab English Radio and this is Asma, at your service as the host. Well, as for our dear guest, I should say today is heaven. I have two of my very dear amazing friends and together we'd provide some captivating, thought-provoking stuff for you. And I forgot to tell you that both of them are Zainab. So I shall add that S on you, Zainab.
Yes. However, okay. I'm Zainab Sadat. Okay, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam.
I have my BA in English Language and Literature and my MA in Teaching English as a Foreign Language. And of course, one of my big interests is in religious studies. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because of my interest and my studies that I have the privilege of sitting in front of you today.
Oh, no, then on the other side, I have my dear one, Zainab
Askari. Yes. Assalamu alaikum. I have done my master's in linguistics from India.
Yes.
And then I am still engaged in religious studies in the Hafsa of Qom.
Previously, we were talking about Muharram and the importance of this month on the heart of each individual, whether it be Muslim or non-Muslim. But we see that there is an effect and the shower of blessing could be just felt everywhere. And we're going to continue talking about this discussion, actually. We said that there is plenty of effects and benefits that would come after this mourning and weeping. And it's not just weeping. It's something that is sacred.
Deeper than that.
Of course. Mm-hmm. There is this fire inside our chest that would never cease to exist. About the rituals of the month of Muharram. You know, because from society to another, it's pretty much different. I mean, we, as living in a Muslim country, mm-hmm. have a sort of special experience. But the other people who are living in a Western country, or just, let's say, very Eastern countries, they would have some different sort of perspective upon these issues.
Even before the first 10th days of Muharram gets started, mm-hmm. the first thing that makes us notice the approaching of the days of Muharram is the black
coverings
in the streets. Mm-hmm. So the first sign is the black covering. And then at the first night before the first day of Muharram, the mornings and gatherings get started. Mm-hmm. And people go in majalis.
And as we grow older, Zainab, these sort of gatherings that you already talked about are starting to grow big and bigger.
Yes, big and bigger. And every person, according to the capacity of his or her character,
is sharing.
Gets something from those majalis or and those gatherings. Mm-hmm. The children, they go, they
we
go
already
play.
Have been there.
Yes, they get things to eat. When they get older, they sit beside their mothers and they just participate.
And
in
that
those.
Actually has an effect upon their heart.
Definitely, yes. There's a big, range of difference between a child who participates in these majalis and gatherings and those who do not. And as I said, as they become older and older, the capacity start to get more and more from these majalis. Mm-hmm. I just really like that.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
What about you, Zainab? How does it look in your society? I mean, you know, as for us, we have this ritual that the coverings are just all black, and then the streets, they also, you know, you look at your neighbors and you see that there are some special slogans that have been hanging on their doors, and then also even the children are going to wear black dresses. So everything is telling you that there is a special situation that is going to happen everywhere.
Black coverings, black earrings, and that's a mark of respect. Why people wear black is because our imams in so many narrations say that our Shias or our followers are those who are happy in our when there's our happiness and who are sad in our sadnesses.
Exactly.
So just to wear black is not a mark of fashion or some trend or some other thing.
No.
Wearing black,
beyond that.
Because in many societies, there's no concept of like why people wear black. You know, in our I have heard this so many times, when in our societies people start wearing black, many would say like the trend started.
You know, Zainab, I would say that even if it's that way, still it would have some effects upon them.
First of all, for all those listeners who don't know why we wear black, black is to wear as a mark of respect, because we believe being sad or expressing sadness with the sadness of our imams is being a true follower. So that's just a mark of respect. That's just a beginning. And then in our rituals, what else we have? You explore the talent of your poetry.
Oh, yeah. Which is very nice and very rich.
And very intellectual.
Exactly.
Very intellectual, emotional at the same time. Yeah. I mean, you don't see many intellectual things being emotional at the same time, but this has got everything.
Half of the stories that have been passed to us were through those poetries.
You even explore the talent within you. You start writing or you start hearing. So that's something that also transmits, that explores you. There may have been questions in many societies, why only like males can sing, why cannot females? Or so even if you have that talent within you, you can explore that in these majalis. Like when you are females all around and you want to read out those poetries, you can explore all your talents. Like it's the matter of doing things at the right place, in the right time. And when you're doing hair, it's also ibadah.
So we also have in our narration that if it is actually from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, I guess, that has been said that if you compromise a poem and then read it to people and then make them cry for us, even a single drop of tear, then you'd be rewarded in the hereafter. So we see that it's a very great thing. So Zainab, speaking of talents of women and their share in this morning, what are the things that would come to your mind when we speak of this?
You know, I don't know whether you have been in Iraq or not. Whether you have witnessed the way they mourn for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. You know, they have some interesting traditions. When Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was murdered, the women in Karbala, they gathered. And they
create circles and then they mourn in a very special way.
Yes, in a special way. In Iran, I have not seen such a case.
Yes, the Arab people who are living here, when
they do that.
They have gatherings, they do that.
Yes, but as I said, it's about Arab people. I don't know whether in India, whether... The gatherings are specialized for women.
Yeah.
There is no single man among them.
They do it behind the doors and they're all women.
And they do not harm their bodies.
Exactly.
You know, since in Islam,
Islam, it is haram.
We're talking of it as a tradition. We're just mm-hmm. introducing a tradition among
yes,
our
what
people.
They do in general.
Yeah. Many people have been to Arba'in pilgrim, and then they know what happens there is exactly what happens in the whole month of Muharram and Safar. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there is no single poor person that would slip without eating, because there's food everywhere, and the people are very generous to each other. They behave as if they've coming from heaven. Mm-hmm. And all that you can see is fraternity and friendship and all the good things that
the
human beings could
I must
do.
Say,
yeah, I must add on that the most food is being fed by Shias, especially
yeah,
during this.
And the rate of charity.
We are just giving some headlines upon the topic of Muharram
yes.
and the love of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the rituals that are held
exactly.
in different countries.
You know, Asma, since you were talking about the rituals, many things just were striking mm-hmm. my mind, as Sister Saadat was mm-hmm. also speaking about that. Even if you just go and search on the internet about Muharram, only some of the very weird or controversial rituals will just come up on the top of the Google.
Yeah.
But that's not the case.
Which seem to be brutal.
Exactly. Violent, brutal, I don't know. But
harsh.
Imam Hussein was never violent.
Exactly.
There was. We have to explore the message.
Please highlight that.
Exactly. We have
Imam al-Hussein was not murdered for that, for to show that type of violence.
Observing this Muharram, we would take out rallies in our area in India, in the Indian-occupied Kashmir, I must say. And then, since there was Shias a minority, and on 8th of Muharram, from 8th of Muharram, these gatherings, these processions were banned. Police would come and they would beat people, and they would not allow them to take out the observe the Muharram or take out processions that way. People turned rebellious. People would, you know, start saying that
would
we
burst
yes.
with anger.
Now, every year would happen that. Every year, this repeats. I mean, people start to take out a gathering, and then police comes and attacks. And my father was one of them always, who would start the gathering, who would start the procession,
and, the police,
and then get arrested,
yeah.
get beaten, and then get
oh my god,
get into jail for like hours and hours, or like for even days, or even weeks sometimes.
Wow.
Then my father learned something. Every year, my father would go there, or other Shia people would join him. They would distribute food.
Yeah.
They would distribute water. Mm-hmm. They would explore the message of humanity, mm-hmm. love, and peace. Because Imam was never violent.
That was the message
exactly.
of Ashura.
That
so
was the
I'm
message,
sure
and that's how
we
have to change our cultures. That's
a
how
lot
we
of things to say,
yes.
and still we have plenty of things to share to the audience, but we're running out of time, and unfortunately we have to say goodbye to everyone.
Yes.
This was all for today's episode of Back to Reality. We're listening to Arab English Radio. I hope you enjoyed our discussion. Once more, I'd like to thank you for your kind attention and support. For more tracks on your favorite subjects, you can visit parsaday.com. But now for me and the entire cast of Back to Reality, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you with His never-sleeping eyes. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim. يا ربي لدي أمة رازقة
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازقة لتصي دليلتك once again.
ليش تأخر عباس من البيان يا حسين من زوري وشاف الراس ثانيا ناديا ليش تأخر عباس
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Hussein, 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 I cry for you in pain, I cry for you. I cry for you in
pain. In the limelight.
In his 2017 decision, U.S. District Judge Hittner found that ExxonMobil committed, over a period of 5 years, 16,386 days of violation under the Clean Air Act, emitting 8 million pounds of hazardous pollutants, more than what's allowed by state and federal laws and clean air permits. We now present you an article written by Josephine Lee under the heading ExxonMobil is counting on Trump-chosen judge to undermine right to sue polluters. New ruling on Environment Texas versus ExxonMobil is expected this August. In its second appeal, ExxonMobil is asking the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to restrict the rights citizens have to sue polluters in U.S. federal court. One presiding judge, Trump-appointed Federalist Society member Andrew Oldham, agrees. The largest American oil company has already lost the 12-year-old Clean Air Act citizen lawsuit twice. In 2010, Environment Texas and Sierra Club sued ExxonMobil on behalf of residents of Baytown, Texas, who suffered respiratory and other illnesses as a result of toxic emissions from the company's Baytown plant, its largest in the world. In 2017, U.S. District Judge David Hittner ordered the company to pay a $20 million penalty to the U.S. Treasury, the biggest citizens' lawsuit penalty to date. After the Fifth Circuit overturned that ruling on Exxon's first appeal, District Judge David Hittner knocked the penalty down to $14.25 million. Now, ExxonMobil is claiming that Baytown residents have no legal standing to bring the lawsuit to federal court, even though the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, maintains its ability to regulate pollutant emissions after the Supreme Court hamstrung the agency's ability to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, and state environmental agencies, like the one in Texas, have faltered in enforcing the Clean Air Act. Citizen lawsuits have long been used to hold polluters accountable when federal and state agencies fail to act. If the Fifth Circuit agrees with ExxonMobil's argument, this would deal a devastating blow to any environmental group or community that seeks to bring a citizen lawsuit to federal court. Sharon Sprayberry is one of the key witnesses for the plaintiffs in Environment Texas versus ExxonMobil. Sharon Sprayberry had first tried reporting to the EPA the incidence of chemical emission flares she witnessed coming from ExxonMobil's Baytown plant, located less than 2 miles away from her home. Sprayberry said, "The first time I heard it, I thought it was a tornado. It was like a freight train roar," adding, "I looked at the sky and it just lit up bright orange. It started at 1 or 2 in the afternoon and it went all night and it never ever got dark." After several failed attempts to get the Environmental Protection Agency to act, Sprayberry says the EPA then passed her on to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, which then twirled me around and did nothing. Using data from the Environmental Protection Agency's own annual enforcement reports, the Environmental Integrity Project found that the yearly average number of inspections, investigations, and prosecutions have declined by half over the past 20 years, a decline that started before the Trump administration. The report cites the Environmental Protection Agency's deference to states to enforce environmental laws as a primary reason for this decline. The Texas Commission of Environmental Quality, tasked to enforce federal and state environmental laws, is headed by 3 commissioners appointed by the governor. This year, the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality is up for review by the Sunset Advisory Commission, a group of 10 state legislatures and 2 laypeople who review the performance of the state's agencies every 12 years. During a hearing, the Sunset Advisory Commission called the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality reluctant regulators. The Sunset Advisory Commission's report notes that the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality relies on the industry to self-report and self-monitor illegal emissions. The agency has no compliance history data for 400,000 facilities, 89% of facilities across the state. Even when facilities do report their emissions, the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality does not pursue any action when plants explain the illegal emissions were unplanned, unavoidable, and properly reported, a legal concept called affirmative defense. According to the report, over the last 5 years, the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality has granted affirmative defenses for an average of 87% of unauthorized emission events reported annually. Another Environmental Integrity Project revealed that the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality only penalized 3% of air pollution violations from 2011 to 2016. Even when penalties are issued by the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality, they're usually small and oftentimes less than the cost of maintaining or upgrading equipment to comply with the emissions standards. In his 2017 decision, District Court Judge David Hittner found that ExxonMobil committed, over a period of 5 years, 16,386 days of violation under the Clean Air Act, emitting 8 million pounds of hazardous pollutants, more than what's allowed by state and federal laws and clean air permits. Before the lawsuit, the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality had failed to issue any corrective action or penalties against the company's Baytown complex. After the lawsuit was filed, ExxonMobil then requested the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality to issue a penalty to them so that the company could get the citizen lawsuit dismissed. According to the testimony of Barry Baisden, ExxonMobil's former manager of safety, security, health and environment at the Baytown complex, and the testimony of John Sadlier, former head of enforcement for the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality, ExxonMobil approached the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality after a lawsuit was filed and drafted its own order of penalty for the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality to issue. The order imposed a penalty of $98,000, half of which ExxonMobil was allowed to pay to the industry-run Houston Regional Monitoring Corp, of which ExxonMobil is a board member. Sprayberry found Environment Texas and joined the citizen lawsuit after years of suffering from respiratory illnesses. Growing up a couple of miles from the facility, Sprayberry was diagnosed with asthma when she was 3 months old, avoided outdoor play and trick-or-treating, slept with her back propped up, and learnt how to read the direction and timing of the wind to breathe. Even with all these precautions, she ended up in hospital with dyspnea, or shortness of breath, several times a year during her childhood, describing the experience as breathing through a tiny, tiny little straw. It wasn't until Sprayberry left Baytown at the age of 18 that she was given new lungs, as she put it. She proceeded to join the U.S. Navy, where they jumped out of helicopters, climbed walls, and endured strenuous physical activities she never thought possible before. When Sprayberry and her mother moved back to Baytown 36 years later for a job opportunity, she found that ExxonMobil plant had expanded exponentially. Her respiratory problems returned, her mother developed heart problems, and she then learned that colleagues in the school district where she was working were dying from cancer. The Environmental Protection Agency's standard for an acceptable level of cancer risk is 1 in 10,000. This means that out of 10,000 people living in an area, there would likely be one additional case of cancer due to exposure to toxic pollutants. ProPublica's map, based on the Environmental Protection Agency's data of cancer risk by pollutant emission, shows that residents around ExxonMobil's Baytown plant face a risk for cancer that is 2.8 times higher than the Environmental Protection Agency's acceptable threshold. Despite all the evidence, Oldham is advancing ExxonMobil's argument that the Baytown residents have no legal standing to bring the citizen lawsuit to federal court. To date, courts have applied what's known as the Cedar Point Powell-Dufferin test on legal standing for citizen lawsuits. According to these precedents, plaintiffs need to show that they have a concrete personal stake in the air quality of their neighbourhoods, that their injuries can be fairly traceable to a plant's violation of the Clean Air Act, and that the violations cause or contribute to the kind of injuries experienced by the plaintiffs. Oldham now wants citizen lawsuit plaintiffs to pass a but-for-causation test. This means that plaintiffs would need to prove that their injury from a specific date could not have been caused by anything other than a specific violation of a specific date. Luke Metzger, Executive Director of Environment Texas, explains that such a requirement is an impossible standard when dealing with large complex plants, which have different emission sources, as opposed to cases where there is only one source of pollutant discharge. Luke Metzger adds that emission events are not always visible to residents, and residents would not be able to tell which emissions are legal or illegal. Luke Metzger said, recognizing that the U.S. government sometimes does not aggressively enforce the law, Congress explicitly gave people a very important tool for reducing pollution themselves. He added, these kinds of powerful tools protect our environment, hold companies accountable, and help prevent future violations. To not allow for full accountability of these violations, where you have to demonstrate a specific knowledge of a violation at a specific time, would be a dramatic departure from current rules around standing. It would have a chilling effect on the ability of citizens to hold polluters accountable if the government fails to do so. Before Donald Trump picked Oldham to be an appellate court judge from a list provided by the Federalist Society, Oldham had already made his mark as a deputy solicitor general and then the general counsel in Texas by attacking the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, which he called an illegitimate administrative state. During his time in Texas, the state filed at least 17 lawsuits challenging the Environmental Protection Agency's authority, two of which Oldham presented in front of the Supreme Court. In 2012, Oldham was already arguing that the EPA does not have the authority to regulate carbon emissions. In his brief for Utility Air Regulatory Group versus the Environmental Protection Agency, Oldham stated that greenhouse gases do not qualify as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act, and that the Chevron deference, a doctrine from a 1984 Supreme Court ruling that guides courts to defer to federal agencies with more expertise, is not explicitly stated in the Constitution.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.